Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Money and Markets. Today is August 7th, Wednesday. We're recording today for publication tomorrow, Thursday. The market's swinging around, John, so much you have no idea what could happen by tomorrow. But for today, what's our theme?
The theme is elevator down, escalator up. Who wins? It's a pattern we've seen before. You have a plunge, then you rise back up. And the question is who wins in this scenario? Right.
There's an old market phrase that when you do get a real meltdown, when you get a turn from a bull to a bear, there's a tendency to go down straight, and then it takes, you know, it.
So that's the elevator.
Elevator down, escalator up. So that's a typical pattern, and we know, you know, every 6-7 years we have a recession. So don't be surprised but we did. We got quite a plunge. Now it's going back up. We'll see what happens. Anyway, let's dive in.
Let's dive in, and let's start as we usually do with the war in Gaza or the genocide in Gaza, and talk about this piece from CBS. It's a video piece. I'm going to run this, and we'll talk about it. But I want subscribers to think we're going to cover to sort of look at this piece and what's talked about, and think about what if Gaza were a model for the way the powers that be would treat all of us. And think about that when we look at this. So let's get this clip rolling from CBS.
When were you in Gaza?
End of April for the first couple weeks of May.
Dr. Mark Perlmutter, an orthopedic surgeon from North Carolina and vice president of the International College of Surgeons, volunteered in Gaza.
So of all the disaster zones you've seen, how does Gaza compare?
All of the disasters I've seen combined, 40 mission trips, 30 years, ground zero, earthquakes, all of that combined doesn't equal the level of carnage that I saw against civilians in just my first week in Gaza.
And when you say civilians, is it mostly children?
Almost exclusively children. I've never seen that before. Never seen that. I've seen more incinerated children than I've ever seen in my entire life combined. I've seen more shredded children in just the first week.
Shredded?
Shredded.
What do you mean?
Missing body parts, being crushed by buildings, the greatest majority, or bomb explosions, the next greatest majority. We've taken shrapnel as big as my thumb out of 8-year-olds, and then there's sniper bullets. I have children that were shot twice.
Wait, you're saying that children in Gaza are being shot by snipers?
Definitively. I have two children that I have photographs of that were shot so perfectly in the chest I couldn't put my stethoscope over their heart more accurately, and directly on the side of the head in the same child. No toddler gets shot twice by mistake by the world's best sniper. And they're dead center shots.
Wow.
So
I mean, we've seen reports like that before,
right?
But this is coming from CBS now, which is very interesting,
right? So I've been getting reports from weeks, but I keep being told that everything's disinformation, that anything about the targeting of children is disinformation, and it's hard to believe that it's disinformation because if you take down that much housing, then you're genociding children, because if children have no shelter, you know, for months and people are bound to get sick, people are bound to die. So, but I've wanted to be extra careful. And here we have CBS. Now, CBS is owned by Paramount, which is owned by National Amusements, which is owned by Sherry Redstone and the Redstone family. And this is not running, in my opinion, unless that chain of command allows it to run. And it ran, if Netanyahu spoke to Congress in, I think, July 25th, 26th, that time frame, this ran last Sunday. So that was, what, August 4th?
Yeah.
After Netanyahu's in the United States, and there's real concern that somebody's trying to start a war, you know, that we have bombing in Lebanon, Syria, you know, an assassination in Iran. So for CBS to run this is extraordinary. But to me, the thing that was most compelling is you have a U.S. doctor with very impressive credentials who was there on the ground in May and is corroborating sniper shots of of small children. I don't see
In other words, the disinformation charge at this point sticks only if he's lying through his teeth, and you're able to assess on your own whether or not you think he's credible. To me, that's a credible witness. I don't think he's lying through his teeth. I think he's telling the truth. And
well,
he's very disturbed by the truth.
You have to have the CBS general counsel, the CBS management, the Paramount, the National Amusement, Sherry Redstone, and the doctor all in a cabal to lie. Now, I will say this, the Pentagon let this run. So we've seen the Pentagon kibosh stories. Pentagon didn't kibosh the story.
Right, and I'll say this, we will see general counsel behavior in another story that is absolutely detestable.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, I just finished watching that one.
Okay.
I watched the whole thing. Right.
What was that?
The James O'Keefe documentary.
Oh, that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the Google
case. Ah, yes. Yes. Okay.
That's really bad. Anyway, but back to the point, we have been making this point on Money and Markets for a long time, which is that, you know, if you think that the powers that be look at children in Gaza any differently, they look at you or vice versa. If you think you have any more rights in the eyes of the power that be than the children in Gaza, you're wrong about that. And there's a piece we'll cover next week that makes that very point and says, you know, Gaza may be the cutting edge of a trend that's with the chickens coming home to roost here in the U.S. This is a story to pay attention to.
Right. And if Gaza, you look at what they're preparing with autonomous robots and drones that are weaponized.
Yeah, right.
They are preparing, the leadership is preparing the armaments to affect this in the United States. And that's why I say if we don't stop it in Gaza, it's coming here.
Right, right. If we don't stop in Gaza, it's coming here.
Right.
So on that cheery note, let's turn to war in the Ukraine. This is just a fascinating story. It's a piece from Simplicius, who we've had on Money Markets before. But this, you know, this is some backstory. We covered a few months ago on Money and Markets, the defense minister at that time, Shoigu, getting kicked out and replaced by an accountant named Belousov. And there was a lot of speculation at the time, like, what's going on with this? And a lot of Russian defenders are saying, no, it's not a demotion of Shoigu. He's fine. But it's kind of a lateral move. It was characterized that way. Now we come to this piece by way of that background from Simplicius on a shakeup in the Russian Ministry of Defense. Here's the piece. Russian Ministry of Defense purges hit fever pitch as Belousov scythes corruption. I don't know why he said say target corruption. He wants to use an SAT word. That's fine. I'm in favor of high standards. Okay. So the whole story is on Russian corruption in the military, basically. And several more big figures have been arrested this week. This week, on July 26th, it was ex-deputy defense minister Dmitry Bulgakov. Okay, here is Bulgakov shown. He was arrested on corruption charges of large-scale embezzlement stemming from his handling of food supplies to the military. So, you know, they are buying steak and this guy Bulgakov is giving him dog food. So he's in jail. He's been arrested. And his house was searched. Okay. What do they find in his home? This is really interesting. What they found in Bulgakov's home, a series of quite grandiosely self-aggrandizing portraits were recovered by the FSB. I guess they're equivalent to the CIA, I think, or the FBI. And there he is, shown with all these medals, the guy, the embezzler. But look at this. And all these pictures, by the way, I'll show you one example here. They have at the center Shoigu, this guy, the former guy who's now Secretary of the Security Council, formerly Minister of Defense. This guy is at the center of all these pictures. Where's Putin? Putin is nowhere to be found in any of these portraits. It's Shoigu and his gang, okay? And all of them. Shoigu and his minion. In each case, who is centered but Shoigu and what some are deeming his gang of underlings? That's really interesting because later, way later on down in the story, we come to this, which sounds a lot like stories you hear out of the U.S. But the big bombshell, the biggest bombshell of all, was a report in July wherein Deputy Chairman of the State Duma, Mikhail Delyagin, announced that 11 trillion rubles, about $100 billion, had been stolen in the Russian Ministry of Defense under Shoigu's tenure. Okay? So there's two points here. First, the allegation is not that Shoigu stole 11 trillion rubles worth of funds himself, which is a massive $100 billion, U.S. dollars equivalent, which is, that's one whole year of Russian defense budget. That's a massive amount of money. And the second point is, this is the guy making the allegation, this character, Delyagin, he's one deputy making the statement based on findings of an unofficial mathematician. And Delyagin is a known muckraker of sorts. Okay, so you might say that that these allegations, and coupled with those paintings, would tend to corroborate the view that it was a demotion of Shoigu, and that the purge now is working its way up. It will eventually take down Shoigu. In other words, you start with the underlings, you flip them, and you roll your way up.
Right. You always take out the lieutenants first.
You always take out the lieutenants first. Right.
Right.
Right. You take out your buttons and you roll up to your captains and so on until you get to the head of the snake. But I don't think that's the case, because of another story we'll see later in Space Military Global Turf Wars. But the sensational part of the story, though, the paintings and the 11 trillion rubles missing and all that, it obscures an important feature of this story, which is there's a purge going on and the people stealing money are being arrested. And a few of them have died in custody.
Right.
Curious. But the arrests are being made and the prosecutions are going forward. That is in complete contrast to the U.S., where you never see that, ever.
So here's the question. Is this a political purge or a corruption purge or both? One thing I will tell you is Russia's survival depends on maintaining an elite which is loyal to the sovereign government, number one, and number two, having an economic military. You know, the U.S. strategy is to spend a tsunami of dollars. Russia can't match that. And it's very hard to run a budget as big as the Russian military or the U.S. military without people starting to think it's their money. I mean, I've seen it. I saw it in Washington all the time.
Yeah, I bet you did.
It's very hard to keep it clean. And when you get growth, as you do with the war in Ukraine, you get this kind of corruption.
Yeah.
And Putin and the Russians cannot afford an uneconomic military. So it doesn't surprise me in retrospect that he brought in an accountant to run the military. Part of it is not just having an economic military, but having a military manufacturing capacity that can swing both military and civilian. So it's very much designed to be economic both ways.
Yeah, right. Another point in that whole story is that it's a point worth noting is that Shoigu is the one person in Russia most connected to the special military operation, what they call the special military operation in Ukraine. He's prosecuting the Ukrainian war.
Right.
He's in charge of it more so than anybody else. So I don't think this is the corruption charges are going to roll up and get him. I'd take the against bet on that one.
I don't know. One of the jobs I'm glad I don't have in life is trying to clean corruption out of Russia.
Yeah, right. That's a scary job.
Right.
But you know, the devil it always seems like it's better than the one you don't. And the one we don't know over here is prosecution ourselves. We don't prosecute people for fraud anymore. We don't prosecute people for, you know this from the 21 trillion story.
So
are even investigations going on? Probably not.
I'll never forget interviewing Bill Binney. If you go back in the archives, our interview with Bill Binney about all the corruption in the NSA and how money everybody was taking. I mean, it's just the stories I get about kickbacks whether it's the politicians or the appointees or the civil service.
Yeah.
It's truly, the whole thing is out of control.
Yeah. That was one of the most disturbing facts that came out in the wake of the global financial crisis was that the Justice Department under Eric Holder and Laney Brewer, it wasn't that they weren't prosecuting people. They weren't investigating people. They were not, there was no subpoenas, no document reviews, no wiretaps throughout the entirety of that. They never did it. And you see that again and again and again, and you never see any investigations or hear about any investigations, which would be handled by the DOJ because they're criminal.
So
I'm the DOJ does criminal matters and nobody else does. They never investigate anybody.
I'm still waiting for the whistleblower who comes forward and informs us what is the treaty between Israel and the United States related to dual citizens, and whether or not dual citizens can receive money and have bank accounts in Israel that are non-reported and non-taxable in the U.S.
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'd be more interested in knowing which the correspondent banking relationships in Israel. I think that would be the tell.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me which bank in Israel has the biggest correspondent banking relationship with J.P. Morgan Chase and with Citigroup, and I'd start there.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, and by the way, when I say the DOJ doesn't prosecute anybody, I mean anybody of size. Small-time fries, you know, mid-sized businesses, it's open season.
Right.
But the big guys on, you know, Citigroup, Jamie Dimon and the like.
Right.
Yeah, not a chance.
Right.
Okay, let's turn to FedWatch. And let's just go to just a tote board, a wet one on Monday. This shows you some of the biggest issues on the stock market. And here they are. It was just a sea of red. So you see the big names, Microsoft, Apple, Google, Amazon, Tesla,
right.
Nvidia.
And part of it is the guys who've run up the most, the momentum stocks are the ones that come down the fastest.
Yeah.
So an elevator down, it's the guys with the biggest bubble that come down. Right.
Right. So this is the elevator on Nvidia, minus 7.25% in a day. Later on in one of the charts, we'll see the escalator, and the escalator is absolutely massive, which is exactly what you just said. You know, the big run-ups have the biggest elevator drops. Okay, let's move on this kind of the same note, is what is Uncle Warren doing in the market? And the answer to that is Warren Buffett is dumping Apple.
And he did that Forbes. After downsizing his Bank of America. So he's been operating with a very significant load of cash.
Right.
Now, if you look at Apple was, and if you look at all the things going on at Apple and in the market, particularly vis-a-vis China, you know, he had gotten enormous gains in Apple, and it was time to take money off the table. So it's perfectly possible that this was just what a disciplined manager could do.
Yeah.
But I also think this comes right after the Bohemian Grove. And it looks to me like you're stockpiling cash.
Somebody
blew the whistle and you got a whole bunch of guys stockpiling cash.
Forbes trots out a couple reasons that Buffett might have done this. And they're interesting. Let's look at them. So he dumps 50. That's a massive amount.
Yeah, that's huge. It's a huge amount.
It's huge. The majority of a major stock, one of the biggest, probably one of his biggest holdings. So he dumps, and the way he dumps it too is interesting. It's 56%, but look at the distribution, and this is in the first half of 2024. So it's a total of 505 million shares, consisting of 115 million in the first quarter, and 390 million in the second quarter. So it's, you know, one unit in the first quarter and over three units in the second quarter. So it's backloaded. One reason he might be doing this is, you know, Apple's tepid growth rate and high valuation. Maybe that's it. And the reason ventured here is while Apple's AI offerings could give consumers a reason to upgrade, the iPhone maker's declining revenues, so there's another one, there's another problem, declining revenues in China, its regulatory woes, and the absence of a compelling growth vector, I'm not sure what that is, but maybe the growth is a problem, particularly if Apple Intelligence, its version of AI, does not prove to be a killer app, could mean Apple will be lucky to achieve low single-digit revenue growth. Another reason down here is, you know, Warren Buffett might have benefit his shareholders if the U.S. might raise capital gains taxes. How about that? So maybe he knows something about the capital gains rate that we don't. And he might be dumping ahead of whatever's coming. I don't know.
I think he knows Apple. You know, Apple has gotten, he's gotten a huge run on Apple. Its growth is topping. And he wants to, he's getting cash. He's stockpiling cash. So I think he sees opportunity ahead and he's stockpiling, he's going to cash.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
And he might have seen what you saw, which is, well, you know, the elevator up is great. The escalator up is
great.
The elevator down is makes me sick and hurts my tummy.
Well,
I'm
here's the thing.
I'm going to get Apple now.
I mean, interest rates have come down sharply this week, but, you know, if you look at the Treasury yield curve at the beginning of last week, it was still 5.5%. If you can sit in T-bills at 5.5% and Apple has topped out and, you know, growth has slowed, why stay in a risk position if you can go to 5.5 and rebalance? I mean,
Now that you've raised the issue, let's talk about that a minute. You know, Japan raises rates from 0% to 0.25%. And a lot of people said that the big sell-off on Monday was due to, you know, fears about the carry trade. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah. So if you look at the carry trade, so Japan has been operating.
So the carry trade is I borrow in Japan at basically zero.
Right.
I park the money in treasuries at 5%. And I have a cash machine. I have an ATM machine.
That's not what they've been doing. They've been borrowing at 0%. And putting it in Apple and the momentum stocks.
Ooh.
Right, exactly. So here's the problem with the carry trade. The carry trade has become so long and so big, and it's so phenomenally levered that, because, so let's go back. Right now, if a short treasury is at 5, 5.5, and the carry trade is at 0, bumping it to 25 shouldn't make a big difference because you still got 500 basis points, right?
Exactly.
Right.
If
you're borrowing at 0% and you're putting it in Apple and AMD and the hot stocks, Tesla, but those are starting to drop, okay, then you've got a problem. Now, what we're talking about is trillions of dollars that is that highly leveraged, and that tells you you've got a very insecure and very frothy bubble there, right?
Yeah, right.
Right, because you still got 500 basis points of spread, right?
Sure, yes, exactly, right.
So the Bank of Japan had an emergency meeting and said they weren't going to raise interest rates probably in our lifetime again. And so then the market, you know, the Nikkei turned around and the market went up and everybody was happy again. So, and there was pressure on the Fed to have an emergency meeting too, because, you know, they'd like to, I think there are a lot of people who'd like to see the Fed bring interest rates down too.
Well, yeah, the cries for the Fed bringing interest rate down started immediately. Anytime there's any kind of turmoil, you know, in the market, the big strong capitalists turn into the biggest babies in the world. Oh God, we need rates to come down. Why is Powell's hurting us? It's unbelievable.
Well, but here's what shocks me, because what I see is the stocks that have gotten all the up this year, their business is control grid.
Yeah, right.
Why do I want to see them go up? I'd love to see them go to zero.
Well,
right?
I don't know about that, but yeah.
Well, but who, you know, which side are you on here?
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Do we
right.
want the stock market to go up? I mean, it's real simple. Let's just affect the control grid, turn us all into slaves, and the stock market will go to the moon. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any event, I don't think, despite what some experts were saying and analysts are saying, I don't think the carry trade had anything to do with what happened on Monday. I think a far more likely culprit
is
what's going on in the Middle East. And that was apparent from the chart on the defense contractors.
Right. Here we go.
It's like as soon as Iran starts to show signs of serious escalation, you see the defense stocks. And we'll see this in the chart.
Well, you see a carrier group head for the Middle East.
Right. All these signs of there's a massive conflict coming in the Middle East.
Right.
The market takes a dump and the defense stocks, by contrast, go to the moon immediately.
Yeah, we're going to look at the defense stocks?
We'll look at when we get to charts. I don't have it in the sequence, but keep that in mind. We'll see it in charts, but they exploded.
The big problem, because when if you're talking about serious outbreak in the Middle East, you could see, everything drop. Everything.
Right. Yes.
Like
everything except Lockheed Martin, because nuclear war is good for that company.
And Raytheon. Raytheon's going to add it. Yeah.
You got it. Yep. Right. Yep. The big five, they're good with they're good with nukes flying all over the place.
Right.
Anyway, let's turn to Lahaina and Hawaii. I'd love to get subscriber input on this story. I'd love to know the details of this one. But this concerns the aftermath of the fire in Lahaina and some lawsuit that's just settled. This is from the Office of the Governor. Dr. Green, announces $4 billion global settlement in principle to resolve Maui wildfire lawsuits. Okay, it's a global settlement. Interesting. The governor announced a historic settlement to resolve all tort claims. And I'll tell you why I keep focusing on all and global. He's going to resolve all tort claims arising from the Maui wildfires. Less than a year. So that's fast. Less than a year after the wildfires in Maui, seven defendants, so the seven defendants are municipalities or utilities except for two, West Maui Land Company and Spectrum Charter. The rest of them are municipalities or utilities. The seven defendants undertook significant efforts to find a resolution that addresses the needs and ensures the well-being of plaintiffs, all affected individuals and their families. Well, I'm not sure about that. It's certainly they benefit, but all affected individuals, not so clear. The seven defendants will pay, but we don't know in what amounts each. In aggregate, they will pay $4 billion to provide compensation to all those who have brought claims, not to everybody in the state, but to all those who have brought claims for compensation arising from the 2023 windstorms and wildfires on Maui, including the approximately 2,200 affected parties who filed lawsuits. So $4 billion divided by 2,200 equals $1.8 billion per party who filed a lawsuit.
Okay. No. Not $1.8 billion.
I'm sorry, $1.8 million.
Right.
Yeah, $1.8 million. That's what that shakes out to be. Okay. The global settlement of over $4 billion will help our people heal, says the governor. And then he says this. This is really interesting. Settling a matter like this within a year is unprecedented. I would imagine so. That's a major lawsuit, $4 billion to get settled in under a year. I've never seen anything like that. Overall, the total scope of recovery, which includes past insurance claims, county, federal, and state support, will approach $12 billion. So the $12 billion of that, $4 billion is this lawsuit. Okay, but the agreement in the lawsuit is conditional on the resolution of the insurance company's claims that have already been paid for property loss and other damages with no additional payments from the defendants. Well, my first question is, are you saying, Governor, that you can't, that nobody else can file a lawsuit based on the fires and get any money from the defendants? That's what it sounds like to me. Like, where are you getting the authority to bar other litigants other than the 2,200 who've already filed suit from filing their lawsuits, independent of the statute of limitations? That's a separate question. But he's saying, if I read that literally, nobody else is going to be able to bring suit and recover from those seven defendants. So there's an aroma about this settlement that I don't
like.
There's
a very bad aroma. I'm reading, one of the residents wrote a book about what really happened, and I'm in the middle of reading it. I'll write a book review when it's done and hopefully get her on the Salieri Report to talk about it. And maybe in that conversation, she'll know what's really happening. My concern is if you look at this settlement, that the real money will not come through to the real people who are hurt.
Right. In other words, the money is going to 2,200 people, or 2,200 entities who in this lawsuit. The other thing I want to point out here in this lawsuit is that the seven defendants, there's a notable absence of any kind of federal defendants in this lawsuit. Is there a separate lawsuit that might be pending somewhere against?
I don't know.
Say the people who's actually set the fires, because remember we looked at that footage,
right?
And you see the footage, like that's not a wildfire. That's a controlled
demolition. No, they're trying to attribute it to the electrical company.
Yeah, which is preposterous. If you looked at the burn patterns,
right.
are geometric shapes.
Okay, right.
Wildfires don't burn geometric shapes. They burn, you know, wild-looking swaths.
Right.
They look natural. What was burned there was not natural. It was.
Well, they have a big development plan for Lahaina, and this is designed to shut everything down and shut them up.
And shut them up.
Right.
The 2,200 people, okay, that's $1.8 million per head. Be quiet. Take your money and go.
So my understanding is you still have a tremendous number of kids missing. I'll see what comes out when I finish this book, but I don't think we've begun to hear the real story on this.
I think that's right. I think that's the tip of the iceberg. And I think that the
right.
real tell there, like I say, is settle this thing fast. Get the books closed on this one.
Right. Somebody had a gun to everybody's head and said, you will do this. We will get this done.
As long as the lawsuit is pending and it's open and it hasn't been concluded, nothing is under the rug.
Right.
It's still subject to squirt out at the least opportune time.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, that's a curious story there, that they were so anxious to get this thing settled and claim victory. Anyway, let's keep it going in FedWatch with the next story from the Financial Times. I'd love to get your take on this one. Private capital groups deploy $160 billion. Gosh, that's a lot of money, as they prepare for a deal revival. And the reason I say it's a lot of money is it's four companies. Ares, Apollo, Blackstone, KKR said they had invested a combined $162 billion between April and June, with Apollo accounting for more than 40% of the total. So $64 billion just for Apollo. Executives at the firm said they are readying for an increase in buyout and merger activity as, I love this, as the U.S. Federal Reserve edges closer to cutting rates. Oh, really? They're going to do that, are they?
Right. Well, remember, they've been sitting on cash. So it says they're still sitting on $2 trillion. So again, if you're getting 5% in the short market, you can sit for a while.
You are correct.
Right?
That's a massive, that's unbelievable.
I'm telling you.
$2 trillion of dry powder.
Cash,
wow.
Stockpile. And one of the reasons I wrote the Plunder series and the two reviews on the Plunder books is I really think what we're looking at after the election is a new, incredible wave of plunder. And if you look at what happened in Tennessee,
right.
you know, with hedge fund money coming in to push out all the conservative candidates,
yep,
they're coming. Now, I just saw, somebody just sent me something. Apparently, J.D. Vance, before he became VP candidate, was mm-hmm. in support of the Convention of States. If the plunder team...
Do you mean a constitutional convention?
Yes.
Yeah,
if they
two
can,
thumbs down on that.
Right. If they can get a constitutional convention, they can kill the First Amendment. They can kill the Second. I mean, they can rip the whole thing up to shreds.
Kill Article I's control of the Fed.
Right. And so then you're talking about the plunder team having a field day. And that's when you want to have tremendous amounts of cash.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, constitutional convention equals rape of the United States.
Right.
Let's be blunt about it.
Right.
That's what you're looking at.
Right.
To be clear.
I can't.
Yeah, that's what they will do.
Right.
And they can't do it now because in Article One, the right to coin money rests solely with Congress, and thus the Fed is not independent despite claims to the contrary. Those claims are legally and factually totally without merit.
This comes down to who controls fiscal policy.
Yes.
You tear up the Constitution, the banks will control fiscal policy.
And monetary policy.
Right. They control it now. Right.
They
want both.
They administer it now. Congress controls it. Congress
right.
has ultimate control over it.
That's true.
Make no mistake about that. But if there's a constitutional convention,
right.
that goes away. There's total transparency by Congress into the Fed now. If there's
right.
a constitutional convention, we become like the European Central
right.
Bank. There's no
I just did an interview with Mark Goodwin and Whitney Webb about what is happening with Tether and stablecoin. And we were talking about how they're setting up the custodianship all in sort of one place, both Department of Justice and the ETFs and a lot of the stablecoin, and how easy and well they're doing seizures and enforcing sanctions. And what they're saying is, you know, this money is as programmable as CBDC. So,
oh, yeah.
So now
oh, yeah.
you're talking about private entities who are playing ball with the Department of Justice and are doing private programming and private sanctions, and there's no obligation to the citizens whatsoever.
Right.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I've started to think a little bit more about what the true role of crypto is, and the more I think about it, the more it looks like a monetary transfer system, transfer money from people to the powers that be. It's sucking money out of the system.
Here's what's more frightening. When you look at tokens for assets, because what they're trying to do is start the equivalent of a crypto that reflects all assets, and you trade from your assets.
Right.
And that's how you can grab all the assets very, very quickly.
Right. Yeah, there's we'll have to touch on that
for
one.
For another day.
That's a massive rabbit hole. Anyway,
right.
Let's turn to an easier story to understand in FedWatch. And that's just kind of a story on the temperature of the economy. About car repossessions. Car repossessions are up 23% in 2024 amid elevated interest rates. Okay. A growing number of drivers seem to be unable to keep up with their auto loan payments, and thus repos are up 23% since last year. It's an interesting number because it's 14% higher than pre-pandemic levels. So, you know, they're up 23% and up 14%. So in other words, there was a lot of money sloshing around during the pandemic, and now the interest rates are going up, so are repos. And normally, by the way, repossessions don't happen unless someone's several months behind. It's not,
right.
You know, a month or two. It's like you're way behind.
Right, and a household will fight like crazy to get the money to avoid that because you need it to get to work.
Right, you got to have it.
Right.
That's an interesting story. That's a big number, too. I mean, 23% in a year. Wow, that's a big increase.
Right. Right.
Anyway, let's turn to a more a legal suit involving Google. This is an antitrust suit. I think this suit started under Trump's DOJ. This case has been hanging around a while. Anyway, but there's been a lot of lawsuits against Google. This is from CNN Business. We'll just touch on the big points. Google loses the suit. It's a massive antitrust lawsuit over its search engine, and it's lost. Google has violated U.S. antitrust law with its search business. This comes out of the D.C. District Court. The company has spent tens of billions of dollars on exclusive contracts. So let me be clear about this. Having a monopoly or something approaching a monopoly, that by itself is not illegal. Right? What they've been found guilty of or what they've lost here is what's monopolization. I mean, that's trying to extend your existing monopoly market power. And that's Section 2 of the Antitrust Act, not Section 1. So that's what they're on the hook for. A company has spent, and this is part of the problem, company spent tens of billions of dollars on exclusive contracts to secure a dominant position as the world's default search provider on smartphones and web browsers. So they go to Apple and say, you know, we know you're developing your own search engine. Why don't we sign a deal where, you know, you provide our search engine exclusively as the default on your phones, and we'll pay you so much money that Apple figures out, well, there's no way to make money. We're not going to get it. We'll make way more money from this deal with Google than we will with our own search engine. That's what Google's on the hook for.
Right.
So they block out would-be rivals such as Microsoft's Bing and DuckDuckGo and Apple. And the judge says, quote, after having carefully considered and weighed the witness testimony and evidence, the court reaches the following conclusion. Google is a monopolist, and it has acted as one to maintain its monopoly, Judge Maida wrote. It has violated Section 2 of the Sherman Act. Now, what the story does not say is what I think is one of the biggest reasons that he went against Google here is that Google's general counsel was guilty of destroying evidence. And that Judge Maida said as much. And it was not Google's first
God.
Yes. Yes. The judge says he's guilty of destroying evidence. And by the way, it's not, like I say, it's not Google's first rodeo with their general counsel destroying evidence. They did the same thing in another antitrust lawsuit where they delete, you know, the court sanctions them for deleting stuff. They issue an order saying, thou shalt not delete anymore, and Google deletes more. It got sanctioned in another case by Judge Donato out in, I think, in the Second Circuit.
Who's
somewhere.
The general counsel?
I don't know. And now that Google comes back, in this case, Judge Mehta finds that the general counsel destroyed evidence in this case and says, well, I'm not going to sanction them because I'm finding the company guilty of Section 2 monopolization. In other words, part of the illegal monopolization behavior was the destruction of evidence.
Right.
That's my read of this case. It's like, you know, you guys are out of control. You're big and powerful and you're a criminal. And
well, but here's
tagging you.
You know, I because of the Ask Catherine, I looked at it and because I was interviewing Whitney, who's just done a big interview on Peter Thiel and an article, I went in and looked at some of his presentations and speeches. He gave a speech at Stanford about why, if you want to make money in business, you need to create a monopoly.
Yeah.
And it's all about the, you know, the way to make money is to be a monopoly, and business is about creating monopolies. And but in all the discussions and interviews I've been watching related to crypto and stablecoin and these various issues, and then of course the momentum stocks in Silicon Valley, you know, what you're watching is a culture that is very significantly divorced from what it takes to be successful economically in a real economy, instead of massively subsidized by the government and allowed to engage in howdy-doody world where you're free to break the law.
Right.
You know, these right. guys live in a culture that is separate from the law. They just don't even... I mean, if you watch the proposals at Bitcoin 2024, I mean, Bobby's proposals were completely in violation of law after law after law. It's like, we live in a world with no law. We just do whatever we want.
Right, right. And this story, by the way, is for me another plug for the wisdom of the founders of this country and for the right. Constitution.
Right.
In both of those cases, whether it's Donato in New York or Judge Mehta out in California, these are Article III judges slapping this company around. And the Article III judges, they're lifetime appointments. There's great wisdom in lifetime appointed judges. They're way more independent than the people and the other people in the other branches of government letting these companies get away literally almost with murder.
Right. So let me just say one thing, and I said it on Ask Catherine, I'll say it here. If the utility industry functioned like Silicon Valley, we would all be dead. We would all be electrocuted.
Right.
Because there would be no integrity in the systems, and the systems wouldn't be safe for humans. Silicon Valley is an industry that has created an entire infrastructure of things that facilitate central control, but have absolutely no quality control and absolutely no integrity.
Yeah.
And they're oblivious because, you know, they've been let loose to build central control as fast as possible, and they're just living on a different planet.
Right. They're on a different planet. Exactly. Okay, let's keep it going. Last story in FedWatch from Tennessee. This is bad. You alluded to this earlier. You will get the government you deserve by someone named Gary Humble. I don't know Gary Humble. Maybe you do.
I do. Gary. I've done several shows with Gary Humble. He and his partner have a very good Tennessee show. He moved from Alabama a couple of years ago and has been trying to do things at a local level and trying to get people interested in excellence in state and local government. And he's been very frustrated because people are too busy watching the entertaining show yes. of, you know, presidential politics, and they're not focused on the nuts and bolts of freedom. Anyway, but he wrote a fabulous article. We had a lot of money come in from out of state and hedge fund money from Pennsylvania. And a lot of the excuse was school choice, but I don't believe that was the real compelling. And you also had, you have a governor who is very much, I would say, establishment globalist focused, and a lot of sabotaging of the local candidates. And of course, the tragedy was Frank Nicely lost his election.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the story is more complicated because we knew we needed a ground game and the campaign wouldn't do it. But Gary writes an article here saying, you know, while you all are, you know, eating popcorn and watching the presidential show, you are ignoring the nuts and bolts of what keeps you free. And
right. He says in the story, let's cut to it, less than 20% of registered voters show up to vote in a primary. And the ones who do are really misinformed. And he said, you know, this primary, Republicans, the conservatives took a bath. And he talks about the numbers here. PAC spent over $5.1 million supporting candidates who basically pledged their allegiance to school voucher mafia, championed by Governor Bill Lee and Washington, D.C. friends. And he said, you know, really, the PACs, even though they're supporting school vouchers, they stay away from that issue. They talk about issues completely unrelated to vouchers.
Right.
And what they do is they just lie about the other candidates, like Frank
right.
Nicely.
Right.
And they said most of the time, because people are misinformed, the lies work.
Right.
He says, what does that say about us? It clarifies that voters are lazy. We are gaslighted by sensationalized media, and then we tend to just leave it there. Voters are not typically concerned with the truth, but they just fall in line with a relatively believable narrative. Boy, is that the truth. Fall in line with any relatively believable narrative that describes the vast majority of people I talk to at all. To the extent I talk to them at all about the news, they buy the easy line from the media, hook, line, and sinker every time.
Well, but here's what shocked me in the Tennessee race. What shocked me is people who moved to Tennessee because Frank Nicely got the taxes lowered, because Frank Nicely got the precious. I mean, if you look at all the things Frank and his group have done over the last 10 years, that has made an enormous difference. You know, I can't tell you how many people I know in Tennessee buy ivermectin and talk about how grateful they are that they can do it. Well, without Frank Nicely, they wouldn't be able to do it, right?
Right.
But
right.
they're not willing to go out. You know, they're not willing to put up money and they're not willing to put up time, but they have all the time in the world for the Howdy Doody show on the presidential election.
Right.
And it was right. very depressing to watch. It was very depressing
yeah.
to watch. But what I said to everybody is, you know, Saleri's all in on real freedom, and that's we're just going to keep doing that. We don't, you know, I can't, I'm not responsible for the rest of you, but we're all in on freedom. And so
yeah, right.
we have only begun to fight. Get ready. So
get ready.
Get ready
well,
for me
that's
to.
That's a big. That's a big you, loss to Tennessee at the state level. That's a major pocket of resistance in the country, and it's being eroded.
I will give you a prediction. First of all, Michelle Renaud won her primary, and I think she'll win the general. She's the Weston Price chapter leader in her area, and is very, very good. So that's some good news. The other thing is Frank. I have a meeting with him coming up, but I think Frank will now take a much bigger role in terms of leading freedom efforts across the country. So he will be free of his legislative role. It's a terrible loss for Tennessee, but I think Frank's going to keep on going. So, and we're going to keep on
news.
Supporting him.
That's so, good, too.
Yeah.
And with that, let's turn to Space Military Global Turf Wars. It's a story. This is the second reason I don't think Shoigu is really in any kind of trouble. The first was Putin's happy with the way things are going in the war in Ukraine. This is the second reason, I think. This is a story from Interfax. Russian Security Council Secretary Shoigu arrives in Tehran. So the U.S. sends aircraft carrier groups. The verbiage, you know, the trash talk escalates out there. Look, things are getting heated. Send Shoigu. Russian Security Council Secretary Sergei Shoigu arrived in Iran for a planned working visit on Monday. The negotiations will address a broad range of bilateral cooperation and its enhancement from security to trade and economic projects. Interesting. You know, you'd think that if the talks were about trade and economic projects, you'd send your finance minister. Send in your security council guy, Shoigu. That's a message they're sending, too.
Yeah, from what we've read about the Army, he's a guy who knows how to make deals, right?
Well, it's really, he knows how to prosecute a war.
Right.
The message Russia's sending, in my opinion.
Here's the new headline today is he had a letter from Putin to the head of Iran saying, you know, we don't want you to attack Israel. It's the announcement today.
Wow. Interesting.
Personal letter from Putin and the Russians trying to intercede and asking for permission to negotiate on behalf of Iran, you know, on the global stage.
Wow. So that's a story to be told.
Right.
That's a developing story, to be sure.
Right. So Putin is putting his personal credibility in line to stop the war.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty big. That's pretty major. I'm guaranteed we follow up on that story next week.
Right. So I still want to know who owns the central bank.
Still don't know.
Because they were apparently unhappy about the stock market going down.
If you don't know who owns the central, if you don't know who owns your central bank, you know who owns your central bank.
Right.
The private guys, all the guys.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The private guys.
The usual suspects. And it's not clear. I go to the Russian central bank website and it's just, you talk about pretzel talk. You can't.
Exactly.
Heads from tails. It's like, okay, I get it. Yeah, I know who owns it. Right. Okay, let's go to Bangladesh. Right. There's a lot of action over there. Mm-hmm. Bangladesh is it's one of the biggest Muslim countries in the world.
Yep.
And 175 million people. It's a serious story over there. What's the best way forward for Bangladesh after its regime change surprisingly succeeded? The prime minister, Hasina, just resigned and fled the country on Monday as rioters stormed her palace, which prompted the military chief to declare a transitional government and an investigation into the deaths that took place throughout the summer's unrest. What's interesting is that on November 26, 2023, Russia warned that the U.S. might orchestrate a color revolution in Bangladesh. And on August 5th, on Monday, lo and behold, ta-da, Bangladesh has descended into the throes of a full-blown color revolution. The victorious side on Bangladesh blames India for propping up what they portray as now ousted dictator. And the investigation might also conveniently implicate Hasina and those close to her for this summer's deaths in order to cover up for the victorious side's role in all of this, just like happened in Ukraine in 2014. I don't purport to know what's going on there, but I find that the allegations of a color revolution very, very interesting.
So the riot is, my understanding, were mostly students. And one of the things that happened is the army refused to shoot. You know, it said, we cannot defend the government because we refuse to shoot the students. There's no way you can stop that many people attacking unless you're willing to use physical violence. And apparently the army met and informed the head of the country they weren't willing to use, you know, they weren't willing to shoot the kids. And Cynthia McKinney had tweeted out, you know, if the kids can do it in Bangladesh, why can't they do it in America?
That's an interesting point, because usually where the powers that be are located, there is violence,
mm-hmm.
right? You, when you see the violence, usually that's like the riots during the lockdowns, right? The Black
right.
Lives Matter riots. Remember those?
I mean, right.
Of course you remember them. Minneapolis, Seattle. It's like, right. Really? These you're telling me these guys in the black hoodies all dressed alike, they're not feds?
Right.
I find that astonishing.
Right. Well, but here's the thing. You have somebody who's run the country for, you know, about approximately two decades. And, a couple of years ago when I was in Bangladesh, it was the highest growth rate of any country in the emerging market. And the growth has come off, you know, between the pandemic and things since, the growth has come off. And so you have a lot of unemployment, a lot of unhappy people. And it's a very, you know, it's a very dense and poor country. So there's a
yes.
lot of tension economically.
I can imagine there is, yeah.
Right.
Anyway,
I'd love to know. I'm gonna email
subscribers have any, if subscribers have any intel on that, I'd love to hear it. And I'd love to hear it in the UK too, which is our next story. And here there is violence. So let's just turn to this. Violent disorder will be punished, warns Cooper. This is from the BBC. So you know it's good. The Home Secretary has warned that anyone engaging in unacceptable disorder will pay the price following unrest in several cities across England, but not London. A wave of demonstrations took place on Saturday, some of which saw bottles thrown, windows smashed, and scuffles with officers and counter-protesters. But not all demonstrations turned violent, only some of them. Tensions have been high after the killing of three young girls at a Taylor Swift-themed dance party in Southport, Merseyside, on Monday. A spokesman for Prime Minister Starmer said the police have his full support to take action against extremists attempting to sow hate. Police have his full support. So police, feel free to go ahead and crack heads over there against any kind of protesters.
So I absolutely believe this is entirely government orchestrated. or I shouldn't say entirely, but if you look at the way immigration has been engineered and weaponized, and then all the efforts to turn the groups against each other, and, you know, it was clear to me from looking at the coverage that these protests, not to say that sincere people didn't show up, but that the whole thing was led by people who were paid. You know, this was started and seeded by paid operators. And I've called my best sources in the UK, and they agree with me that that is the case. So,
wow.
And the government is pushing hard for digital ID and biometrics. This is, you know, one way how you're going to get the control model.
Yeah.
So I just think there's, I hate to say it, that I don't think there's anything the UK government won't do to just gin up the excuse and try and get the population to support digital and central control.
I totally agree with that.
Right.
I think that's exactly right. I think the tell in that story is, you know, Starmer giving the police the green light to crack ads.
Right. Right. I think that's why they switched prime ministers. The last guy didn't want to do this. He wasn't sufficiently evil.
Yeah, maybe.
Right.
Could be.
Right.
Yep. That was sort of an easy read, that tell from the BBC. Just go ahead, go sick them. But I think your read on that is exactly right. I'm glad to hear that some subscribers piped in on that one.
Right. And so if you're in the UK, send your thoughts, send what you're seeing, send all the intelligence you can, because we'd love to know more. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's turn to Hey Robot and Crypto. This is kind of an easy story, this next one. It wasn't just the stock market that got crushed on Monday. It was crypto, too, and big time. Crypto itself wipes out $270 billion in value as Bitcoin and Ether plunge. The market's plummeted, led by a drop of 11%. So you saw Nvidia was down 7%. That pales in comparison to Bitcoin.
So during the Bitcoin 2024, I looked at Bitcoin. It hit 70,000. The next time I looked at it, I just happened to look at it at the intraday low when it hit 49,000. So, you know, if you bought it on the excitement of Trump or Bobby's speech at Bitcoin 2024 and you bought it at 70, you had to watch it hit 49.
Right.
That's painful.
That's painful.
Right.
The story says the drop in stocks was tied in part to disappointing earnings, weaker than expected jobs reports, higher unemployment, and declining manufacturing sector. I don't think that accounts for that much of the drop. Interestingly, they point out the world's largest cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, is still trading at about $54,000, which is still up over 23%. The drop in Ether, by the way, was 21%. So Bitcoin down bad, Ether down worse. I think the takeaway from this story, though, is, you know, once the SEC allowed for ETFs to be for cryptos to be traded in ETFs, crypto and the stock market are now tied to the hip.
Yep. And it's just going to get more significant. So you're seeing a giant sucking sound of crypto into those ETFs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
In other words, it's hard to see a scenario where crypto would kind of rock it up one day in the market and equities go down.
So here's the big push, and you can learn more if you watch the interview that I did with Whitney and Mark. But what they're trying to do is, I don't know if you remember in the 90s when they ballooned the balance sheets of hedge funds, they got all these hedge funds to basically create entities, and then they had the hedge funds buy treasuries and they ran sort of a hedge book. Think of it as a Bermuda carry trade, if you will, but designed to just balloon the cash available to treasuries. That's what they're trying to do with stablecoins. So I don't want to use Bitcoin to transact with because the price is volatile. So
I
buy Tether. I buy a dollar of Tether, and Tether goes out and buys a dollar of treasury bills and runs a match book. And if they can get 5% on Tether, you know, when a dollar is a dollar, but they get the 5% skim, you can do this all day long. It's just like a money printing machine, right? And what they're hoping to do and what Trump was promising is hundreds of billions of dollars of stable coins, all stabilizing the dollar. You're creating a huge new market for treasury bills, right?
Right, for sure. But make no mistake about it, the market and crypto are now tied together by those ETFs.
So,
and but, we all know Bitcoin is tied heavily to energy, right?
Right. So the stock
indirectly,
market.
Indirectly, the market is tied to energy.
Right. So stock market, bond market, crypto market, Bitcoin market, energy market, all fusing.
All harmonizing.
Right.
Which takes us to our next story from Visual Capitalists about Microsoft and Microsoft's use of energy.
Right.
Take a look at this. Microsoft's electricity use has doubled amidst AI push, yet another technology that's an energy hog, AI. So in fiscal year 20, it was 11 terawatt hours. And in fiscal year 23, it's 24. Let's just pop. This is interesting too, this little piece here. Training GPT-4, which Microsoft uses, used up to 62 gigawatt hours, equal to the energy needs of 1,000 U.S. households over 5 to 6 years. So Microsoft's electric bill going through the roof.
But
again,
cows,
more energy
cows are the problem.
What? Oh, yeah, right.
Cows are the problem.
Right.
So yeah, Mark Zuckerberg bought a $300 million yacht that is the size of a football field. Wait, do you
no
see?
No problem. No problem there.
No problem. Not a net zero. No. We're gonna achieve net zero.
No, that's not a problem at all. Nor is it a problem for people to fly to Davos in their private jet. Okay, none of that's a problem. It's cows that are a problem. And by the way,
right.
Those cows, they probably have bird flu.
They have bird flu.
They got bird flu. Real problems. Incredible. Okay, let's turn to Farmageddon. Kind of no surprise here, but this is an interesting survey from MedPage today. Trust in doctors crashed during the COVID pandemic and remains low. What's the problem? Putting financial motives over patient care. Man, that was the reason for patient mistrust survey found. Let's take a look. Look at the size of this survey. This is breathtaking. Okay. Over 400,000 unique respondents. That's a massive survey.
That's a huge survey.
That's incredible size. I've never seen one that big. The proportion of adults who agreed they had a lot of trust in physicians and hospitals declined. Okay, so you got, there's no, what's the margin of error on this? Like plus or minus 0.1%? It's tiny. Look at this decline from 71.5% in April 2020 to 41% in January 2024, reported in the JAMA network open.
Now, if you read Plunder and you read Morganson's book on the They Are the Plunder,
yeah,
that correlates with a growth of ownership of hospitals, doctors' practices, and nursing homes by private equity companies. So that reflects the movement of private equity into the medical world.
Yes, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But let's talk about the numbers. So before the pandemic, it's 7 in 10 put a lot of trust in doctors in the medical profession. Now it's 4 in 10. 30% of the people have had their bell rung during the pandemic. That's a astonishing.
Well, what's
number.
Amazing to me is 4 still trust doctors and hospitals.
That's, you know, I've seen that so many times. To see a drop this big, you never see
right.
that.
Right.
But let's look at the MedPage dives a little bit more into the grander detail about what's behind the survey. High levels of trust in physicians and hospitals were associated. So that's what you mentioned. Like, why do people still trust hospitals? Who still trusts hospitals? Man, here you go. High levels of trust in physicians and hospitals were associated with greater odds of getting vaccinated for COVID-19 and influenza compared with having no trust at all. How about that? Some people, they love those vaccines, you know? But 30% of the population is like, nah, I'm gone. I think the takeaway here is I see a number like that. There's no way you're getting away with a second pandemic.
So let me ask you something. Which group has a higher life expectancy?
Well, who do you think? Hold that
thought. I think over time you're going to see a real bifurcation in life expectancy.
We're going to see a bifurcation this episode, actually.
Right. Okay.
Pretty sharp one.
Okay.
But not on the end of the spectrum you're talking about, on the other end. But let's turn, you mentioned private equity in hospitals. That's our next story. Take a look at this. This is from, again, this is, you know, the stories that we talk about in money markets years in advance, they percolate into the mainstream eventually. It just takes time. But here we go. Round two, mainstream media, you know, gets a hold of the obvious. NBC News. After private equity takes over hospitals, they are less able to care for patients, say top medical research. Really? Yeah, no way. Yeah, take a look. This is Gretchen Morgenson. This is the woman, she wrote the Plunder book, right?
Gretchen Morgenson is an incredible investigative reporter. She is, I'm really impressed by her.
Yeah, usually the name is Gretchen and Josh Rosner, but he's not in this article. But here's what she says. After private equity firms acquire hospitals, the facility's assets and resources diminish significantly, leaving the facilities less equipped to care for patients, according to a new study by physician researchers at several very prestigious universities. The research highlights a pattern of what? Asset stripping at healthcare facilities purchased by private equity firms? No. The PE firms say, we bring capital into hospitals. That's why we're requiring the hospitals. It turns out that's not true. They're in the hospitals stripping assets and selling your MRI machines, selling your stethoscopes. They're going crazy.
Well, I think it was Brendan Ballou. I can't remember which Plunder book it was, and I recommend both of them very strongly. Nursing home during COVID, nursing homes owned by private equity had a 10% higher death rate.
Yeah.
You were significantly more likely to die if you were in a nursing home owned by a private equity firm.
Yeah, we've said that before. You go to a hospital. Hospital is a good place to go to die. You go in a hospital in the U.S., good chance you're not coming back out.
I just had a terrible question and asked Catherine. It was devastating. Somebody said, I have a very trusted advisor, worked with him for years, very happy at Janie Montgomery in Philadelphia, and they've just announced they're being purchased by KKR. What should I do? Tell your advisor to go find a new home. Tell your advisor to find a new home. Yeah. It's terrible. You know, it's terrible.
That is bad.
Before you do business with the company, you need to know who owns them.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
Okay, let's go to our last story in Farmageddon. Last week, we had a chart on the child vaccine schedule. And it was really a table, not a chart. But it was a table showing, here's a list of all these childhood vaccinations. And let's look at whether they've had long-term studies. And let's look at whether there was a control, like a placebo in the study. And the great majority of them was no long-term study, no placebo, no control group. This is a follow-up to that, okay? This is a study by a physician, and it's a video. By a physician who really a pediatrician, who looked at the numbers. He compared vaccinated children in his practice to unvaccinated children. That's what this video is about. Let's roll it.
We were definitely looking at every single patient born in my practice. There was no cherry picking. There was no, we're going to exclude you for this or that. Every baby born was looked at, and we looked at every single office visit. We stratified them according to the number of vaccines they had.
Okay.
So basically we had over 500 who had zero vaccines, and then we had another 3,700 and some who had some vaccines. And what we found, Dell, was actually even mind-boggling for myself. What I was clearly seeing was these kids don't get sick. They don't get chronic conditions. Well, the data spoke for itself, and you're showing your viewers the graphs.
Yeah,
those orange lines are over time, over that 10 and a half years, the more vaccines you had, the worse you were for whether we looked at infections, ADD, ADHD, neurodevelopmental issues, eczema, allergies. It doesn't matter what we looked at. Even just plain old anemia skyrockets in the vaccinated when compared to the blue line, the unvaccinated.
Wow.
This data is so powerful.
If I had access to this information before my daughter was born, I would have made very different choices. Every parent wants the best for their child. Every parent deserves access to all the information to make an informed choice.
Wow.
So that's Dr. Paul Thomas from Oregon. He, James Lyon Wheeler, who is going to be on Financial Rebellion with Carolyn and me next week, came in and they did a complete study of the non-vaccinated, lightly vaccinated, and heavy vaccinated kids in his practice. And it was an astonishing amount of work. When I first had James Lyon Wheeler on the Solari Report, this study was one of the things that persuaded some subscribers. They were able to use it with their family to persuade them not to take the COVID injection. Because what Thomas documents, John, is how much money he made, how much more money he made from the vaccinated kids.
Yeah.
It is not, because the unvaccinated never get sick. So he doesn't make money from them. They're not very profitable. And he's able to document how much more he makes from the lightly and heavily vaccinated, you know, over many, many years. And it's astonishing. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. And you see why doctors, you know, are kicking non-vaccinated kids out of their practice, because the insurance companies give you bonuses for the, you know, the more and more you get vaccinated. And when you you look at the numbers, what you know is this is a poisoning and it's intentional.
Right.
This is an intentional.
It gets back to, you know, it circles back to two things. One, you know, the story we saw for the decline and trust in doctors was directly tied to vaccinations. And two, this gets to the Gossification of the U.S. The IDF shoots kids, shoots toddlers with bullets, with rifles. We shoot them with needles.
Right. But it's one is much more gruesome, but they both result in extraordinary death.
Yes. Right. Or disabilities.
Right.
You know, they turn into lifelong cast machines for the medical industry.
Right.
In the pharmaceutical industry.
So Skyhorse published a book about the persecution of Dr. Thomas, because after he came out with a study, the medical board went after him. And there's a whole book on the topic, if you're interested. But it's an astonishing body of work. And when we first published the interview with Lyons Wheeler, I'll never forget, I had one subscriber who was able to talk a family member out of taking the injection, despite all the pressure. And she said, you know, I just couldn't believe that the doctors would lie to that extent. And it wasn't until I understood how much money they're making and I understood the financial incentives of doctors to do this that I thought, oh, okay, then it could really be true.
Right, right. The other interesting part of that story is at the front of the segment, he says 500 unvaccinated kids in my practice, 3,700 vaccinated kids. So it's about 12% of the kids he was seeing were totally unvaccinated. I wonder whether that's unique to him or is that a general figure. In other words, about 12% of kids are completely unvaccinated. That's a kind of a high number given all the pressure for vaccination, whether it's advertising, whether it's propaganda, or whether it's coming from people or from pediatricians themselves, because they're motivated to push vaccines.
Well, it depends on your states. In the states where you have high homeschooling, so Oregon, I would expect a higher vaccination rate than you would get in a place like Tennessee. But one thing I will say is when the vaxxed bus, when Polly Tommy made vaxxed, and then she and Sheila Ely and some of the others started traveling around the country on the vaxxed bus, and you see this on the documentary, suddenly all sorts of people started showing up with unvaccinated children. Oftentimes because the first child had been damaged by a vaccination and then the subsequent children weren't vaccinated.
Right.
And you saw the extraordinary difference in the health patterns of the vaccinated kids versus the unvaccinated. And you really see it in Vaxxed 1 and 2. So, of course, Polly's coming out with Vaxxed 3 in September. So if you're interested in this topic, watch Vaxxed 1 and 2, and you will never, ever let anybody you love get vaccinated again.
Wow. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. That was a powerful video clip to me. It ties in with that crazy vaccination schedule. That's just a criminal schedule to jab your kids. I mean, you kid me. Anyway, let's turn to pushback. Interesting story to bat lead off on pushback this week. Concerns Project Veritas and James O'Keefe. Let's look at this. This is from LifeSite. Documentary indicates James O'Keefe attended Bohemian Grove, suggests he's a CIA asset. Whether those are true, it ignores that. That's not the most serious allegation to me. Let's just take a look. A thorough two-episode documentary from a former Project Veritas journalist includes apparent voice recordings of well-known founder James O'Keefe admitting he attended the infamous and secret Bohemian Grove summer camp for the powerful in Northern California. Yeah, okay. I admit I won the Boston Marathon, to use Noam Chomsky's. I don't know. Let's look at this, though. The film also presents evidence charging O'Keefe with suppressing bombshell reports obtained from undercover journalism and suggests he is a CIA asset whose mission during COVID-19 scandemic was to draw out pharmaceutical and other whistleblowers to his organization, scuttling the major stories and protecting the powerful while publishing only lowballer reports. That's what's interesting. You cite J&J as an example. So they have a group that witnessed what the young whistleblower, there was a young whistleblower who explained, what I saw at J&J was black circles and what looked like parasites revolving around them as if they had a mind of their own, referring to J&J's COVID vaccination. But the story never sees the light of day. Instead of releasing this story that several members of the Project Veritas team witnessed themselves, this person, the journalist, states, this entire story was buried by Project Veritas. I find that very credible. I have always been suspicious of James O'Keefe because he's such a promoted figure.
So if you watch, it's in two parts in this Lifeline article. I watched both parts. So it's about 2 hours of content. And if you look at the stories he suppressed, this is bad. He suppressed some real stories. And you can come up with excuses on the first one he uses, a legal excuse. You know, but if you look at all the stories he suppressed, including one on Twitter, something stinks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other question I had about O'Keefe is not just he was being promoted heavily. It's the access he has. You know, if I try to go out and interview people that he had access to, they wouldn't let me in the door. And I have experience of this. You know, I made a movie a few years ago and tried to interview a bunch of people. I know what, you know, they're not, if they don't know who you are, you're not getting in the door to talk to a lot of people, vast majority. The fact that he's being let in the door routinely to talk to highly placed people, he's a highly placed person himself. That's why he's in the door.
So there's something, you know, what I judge it on is the stories that have been suppressed. And if you look at the stories that have been suppressed, there's something that stinks there.
Yeah.
And, you know, here's what I always want to say when I watch the stories that he suppressed. So if you look at the stories about the Pfizer injection that he suppressed, you know, I want to look at him and say, how many children should die so that you can do this? You know, how many, I want to look at some of these doctors and say, how many kids should die so that you can do this? I mean, it's just, you watch some of the Pfizer scientists who are going along and they know it's wrong and they know how dangerous it is.
Right.
How many kids is it okay for you to kill? There is an inability to take personal responsibility and understand, you know, if I participate in a genocide, I'm guilty. And in the court of karma, you can't get out of that. That's real.
Yeah.
And we seem to have forgotten that.
You know, I really want to take a look at that documentary because one of the questions I would have first and foremost is, do they talk about the agreements that the whistleblower signed with Project Veritas or with O'Keefe? Because again, the devil's in the details.
Right.
You know, I'd like to know, are those agreements exclusive?
Right.
Does he say, you know what, we'll get you exposure, but you got to sign an exclusive here.
Right. And they have the general counsel holding on to, you know, so they take his recordings from Pfizer. And they transfer them off the Project Veritas servers and they take them to the outside general counsel, who's the guy who represented Gotti.
Oh, really?
Jeffrey Lichtman. That's why I thought you were asking me that general counsel story, you know, because the way you suppress things is you give them to the outside general counsel. That's how you.
Right. You claim attorney-client privilege. I can't disclose that. That's protected by attorney-client privilege.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's classic scumbag maneuver in the legal circles. Yeah.
Right. Right.
No, that's not why I raised general counsel. I raised it because of Google destroying.
Now, I will say in defense of some outside counsel, when the Department of Justice tried to steal, we had servers and they seized our office and they insisted we back them up again. We said, no, you back them up. You know, we're tired of paying. This is like the third round of backups. You back them up. So the FBI came in, and it was so cute because the FBI guy got so frustrated with the Department of Justice. Before he left, he gave me his card and asked me for a job. But I'd rather work for you. Anyway, he was wonderful. Anyway, they finish backing up, they leave, and they come back in the next morning. And that night we went in and got our servers and took it over to our law firm's office and put it there. And the guy from the HUD general counsel's office said, he came in, he said, "Where's the server?" And my guy who runs the facility said, "We took it last night." And he said, "You can't take that. I'm under orders. You may not have a copy of the data." And that's why they could never frame us, because we had a copy of everything.
Right.
They could never. Right. Same thing happened to Bill Binney. The difference between Ross Ulbricht, Bill Binney, and me was Binney and we were able to keep a copy of the data. And I only kept it because I moved all the servers to the law firm.
Yeah. My legal mentor told me early on back in Chicago, you give somebody your only copy of something, that is legal malpractice.
Right.
He was kidding.
Absolutely.
But the point was well taken.
No, yeah. Absolutely. That's what they would try and do. They would try and pull it all in, and they were going to steal that server.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Last story in Pushback this week is a good one. This is really a reference for subscribers. This is really wonderful. Brave citizens holding employers accountable for COVID mandates. So the third, fifth, sixth, seventh, ninth, 10th, and 11th Federal Circuit Court of Appeal and 11th Federal Circuit Courts of Appeals have issued 10 appellate decisions since May supporting religious and moral beliefs for employees who didn't want the COVID shot and or testing. And here's a summary. I'm just going to read one of them from the 8th Circuit out west. Employers can't judge if an objection is truly religious. Religious beliefs don't need to be logical or consistent. A testing objection was upheld. Science can be part of the belief. It may be part of judging how something is bad for you. And so anyway, this is a great summary of cases around the country. And these are courts of appeals.
Yeah,
so
I'm in charge of my religion.
This is one level down for the Supreme Court. This is the law of the land you're reading
here.
Great summary.
Right. The central bankers cannot expertise and control religion. If the courts affirm that my religion is my religion and I have the right to choose, it's fantastic. And right. Mendenhall, who's a attorney from Ohio, has done a great job of trying to defend people's rights in this area. So kudos for him on doing that on Substack.
Yeah. So the link will be in the PDF show notes. Check it out. It's really a good summary. And it's short. Like that one I read, it's one or two sentences long. They give you a really, really great quick summary of the state of the law about religious exemptions to vaccinations, involving employers too. You know, they're reining in some of the abuses by employers.
Yep.
Okay, let's turn to charts. It's going to be a heavy chart week because there's been a heavy action in various markets. So let's start with our old friend FinViz with a very different looking FinViz
chart.
Cocoa
Puffs are not number one this week.
They're not number one. Let's check. And VIX is not in the basement. Where's VIX? Normally,
it's
VIX
at the
is
top.
Way down here
so,
at the very bottom. Nope, not this week. It's
all the way
very
at the top.
Top.
So what they call this is risk on, which means people realize, oh, there's real risk. There's real risk in the market.
Yeah. And the breakfast items are, they're still green, but they're barely green.
Yeah, but if you look at the red, what it says is, it feels like a recession.
Yeah, that another point on that is there was a huge drop on Monday in the stock market, and then a kind of a huge rally on Tuesday, and from what I understand as we go into recording this on Wednesday, it's rallying again. Same thing happened in 08. You see these days $1,000 points down, 800 points up. The big gains happen in rough times, not in good times.
Right.
Those massive, wild gains.
That's not
a sign of health.
Right.
That's a sign of trouble, of volatility.
Nobody knows where the price is.
And that's what you're seeing here with VIX way at the top.
Right.
A lot big, what do you call it? Big trouble in River City.
Yep.
Okay. Next up we have, here we go.
So RTX is Raytheon, LMT is Lockheed. So these two big defense contractors. Interestingly enough, if you look at the defense and aerospace ETF, it's not up as much because the aerospace are dragging it down. And then the S&P. So we're looking at year to date.
Yeah.
And what you see is the S&P up 10% year to date.
But this is where the
action. Look at that. Look at that. Look at that. So you know, you can see in the middle of July the S&P and Raytheon are in the same place, and now Raytheon is, you know, 25 points ahead of S&P. That's a huge jump.
It's 45 points spread.
Yep.
No, you're right. It's 25. Yeah. It's 25. Yeah. But that's an enormous. Oh, look at these guys are just explode up. Yep. Those are huge gains. You know?
Right. And Raytheon is my vote for the invisible weaponry king. I'd like to dig down and see. If anybody has time to dig down and see what the big jump on Raytheon is, let us know.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, next up. Oh, Nikkei 225 versus S&P.
How's that for a mind-boggling drop? When you're long a position and you take that kind of elevator down, ooh, that is stomach wrenching.
It is, but they're not telling you where. So this right here, about 95%, 95% gain. So you're down, you know, 15% in very short order.
Right.
I have my lawnmowers are here. Can you hear them?
It's anyway. Not too bad. Not too
okay.
bad.
Okay, good.
So this is the going direct phase. So this is from August 2019 when they voted for the going direct. And what's remarkable is how hand in hand they are until.
Is remarkable. The correlation is so strong between the two.
Yeah. I will say one thing. What is astonishing about Japan, because I've underwritten the whole Japanese market company by company, they have so many beautiful companies. I mean, the Japanese, when it comes to governance and management, the Japanese are amazing. Yeah. They are just amazing. So
Yeah. I represented Mitsubishi Heavy back in the day. They were a great client. Wow.
Really? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Okay. Let's keep it going on charts. With next up we have US dollar index from going direct reset.
Yeah, now what's interesting is you know, we see the dollar really fly during the pandemic. Now here's what's interesting. When you get a period of fear like this, a lot of times, and everybody's in the dollar trap, you would expect to see the dollar stronger, but it's not. So it's been going sideways, but it's off in this period. And but it's basically going sideways in the 103 area.
Yeah, that is a sideways looking chart.
Yep.
Okay, let's keep it going. U.S. dollar, Japanese yen.
Yeah, so this shows the relationship between the U.S. currency and the Japanese currency, and
So this is, to be clear, this is dollar strength,
right?
Because you need more yen to buy $1,
right?
Yeah,
right.
And that inflection point, by the way, the minimum here is in July or August of 2021, right?
So that's end of the year. I think that's end of the year.
Yes, it is. It's the end of 2020. Sorry,
right.
That's the very end of 2020.
It's when they started to give the shots.
So at the end of 2020, that's very interesting.
Right.
When they start to give the shots, you need 104 yen to buy a dollar. Now you need basically 150 to buy a dollar, 150 yen. So the dollar has gotten way stronger.
Right.
Yep.
Right.
That's interesting. Injections as a financial instrument.
Of the reasons I looked at all these charts was I was trying to figure out, has something repositioned between Taiwan, China, and Japan? And that's why we're going to look at the semiconductor chart, because I wanted to know what was happening with Taiwan semiconductor.
This semiconductor chart is, okay, remember 80% for the S&P and the Nikkei 225 in about 5 years? Right, that's a pretty good gain, 16% a year. Okay, look at this next chart. This is the semiconductors.
Right, so
Whoa.
We see the AI chips really flying. Okay, AMD, one of the things that's interesting, I didn't put Intel in this chart, but AMD has really started to draw significant volume from market share from Intel. And Intel just canceled their dividend for the fourth quarter and took a 20% nosedive before the fall started on Friday.
Yeah.
Anyway, but this is AMD and Taiwan Semiconductor. which have performed very, very significantly during.
They're great, but look on this chart, they look like losers. They're four times the S&P. But they look like dogs in this chart.
Right, right. So, but this is the control grid significantly, you know, and digital technology significantly outperforming the broad market.
And this
is the AI.
What is that's AI?
That's right an AI there. Bubble. I just think that's an over promoted AI bubble.
Yeah. So again, you know, we're getting these tie-in with markets and these technologies, the times in the stock market and Bitcoin. And now here in this chart, you're seeing the tie-in between the stock market, part of the stock market, and AI, right?
And here's what we're not seeing. And this is why, you know, I'm not so bullish. When a stock market is promoting stocks that are bad for people, you know, I don't associate a rising stock market with good news.
Right.
So, right. You know, we're not in a world where what's good for General Motors is good for America at all.
Right. There's a huge bifurcation.
Right. There's right. a huge bifurcation. And a lot of what's going on is plunder capitalism.
It is the private equity in the hospital story.
Right.
You know, private equity comes and all of a sudden their horses run into the hospital.
Right.
You know, it's not a good hospital for
right.
you.
Right. So you're extracting value and bankrupting a company, but the KKR stock is flying. Right.
Right. Right. Exactly. Okay. Let's turn to something that the safe haven, the safety trade.
Right.
Here we go.
So here's what's interesting. If you look at what's financing the bubble, it's the U.S. taxpayer.
Exactly.
And the U.S. taxpayer's pension fund is buying treasuries. The Social Security fund is buying treasuries. Their retirement savings are buying treasury. If Bobby Kennedy has anything to do with it, they're going to issue another trillion treasuries to buy Bitcoin. And so what it says is the American people are financing this and taking huge losses to finance this game. Now, this is a chart. So this is the going direct period. And this is TLT is the 20-year Treasury ETF. And then we see the GLD ETF up 55% and SLV up 43%. And they've had a very good year this year. And silver was running higher, but gold has now recently surpassed silver. Right. So.
And those are good numbers, but they're not the S&P, which is 80%. And they're
right.
for sure not NVIDIA, which is 2,200+%.
Right. Right. But anyway. If you're going to be... Now, here's the thing. If you have a war, you know, I remember, you know, a couple times in the past where people thought gold was going to protect them during the war, and you just see a deflationary nosedive of
yeah.
people having to sell their gold to raise cash to, you know, whatever, feed their kids.
Right.
So don't assume that any risk asset is going to protect you in a war scenario. So
yeah, right.
Right.
Right. Okay. Well, that's it for charts. What a week for charts. But the spread from, you know, your point is well taken. All of this action since going direct reset has occurred on the back of the treasuries.
Right. Right. And if you look at how the American people are being composted,
yeah.
you know, that is one of the major ways they're being composted.
And that's the perfect description for it. It's a compost thing.
Yeah, it's
people.
Compost. That's why when people keep saying, oh, it's going to collapse, it's going to collapse. No, it's not.
No.
You know, segments of the population are being collapsed.
Yes.
You know, and that's a compost. It's not a collapse. So stop
right.
waiting for the Big Bang collapse. That's not.
Right, it's not. Right.
right.
You're gonna be gradually turned, your brain's turned into tuna fish, and your insides are turned into worms to the medical
Right, so
field.
It's plunder capitalism. So
you're
plundering certain segments and certain portions. And that's yeah. our goal here, is to make sure you don't get plundered. Right?
right. Don't get right. composted. That's
right.
what you don't want.
That's right. right. Look at John. Does he look like a man who's being composted? No. You know how to live.
Yeah. I did, by the way, I did hit my goal on biking of clearing 6,000 miles in 2 years. The final number was 6,000.
I am so jealous. I've got
6,067 miles in 2 years.
How many miles a day on average?
I think it comes out around 17. I tried to do 10 miles a day, and I couldn't do it.
Uh-huh.
So I was going to do 10 miles a day for a year, and I couldn't. I wasn't up for it. So I retrenched a little bit. It's like, okay, I'll shoot for 6,000 miles in 2 years. That's the point of it was 250 miles a month.
Right.
That's the average.
Right.
That's what I was
okay.
after.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, okay. Good on. Let's go to Soleri.
Let's go in-house, Soleri. Here we go. It's a short week for us.
Okay,
what do we got here? Cybercrime.
Yeah, I only posted two things because of how many charts we had, but we did a great interview with Bob Sullivan, which is now up and available. Bob Sullivan is he's one of the top investigative reporters in the country on crime targeted at individuals, cyber crime, internet crime, you know, sophisticated fraud. And, you know, you and I have talked, John, about how many, many corporations are moving to literally systemic financial fraud models. Bob is focused on how many of the cartels and the criminals are focused on adopting Fortune 500 corporate techniques. And it's frightening. I mean, it's really frightening. And they are making a fortune. And you want to understand that this kind of technology exists and these kind of scams are happening because they're getting much more sophisticated. And even if you are immune to them, I'm sure you have family and friends who are susceptible. So I strongly recommend, you know, Bob Sullivan says, look, to fix this problem, it's not enough to educate consumers. And I agree with him. You need attorney generals and others to move, but it certainly helps to be educated because you have no idea how sophisticated these guys have gotten.
It also helps to be very skeptical about any claims you see coming through your computer.
Right.
Whether they're graphical, audio, whatever.
Yeah.
Very skeptical.
Right.
When in doubt, turn the power off of your computer.
Right. And I just want to say, you know, Silicon Valley, shame on you. You have created an industry which is, its goal is control and extraction, and it fails to perform.
Yeah.
It fails to perform. It's not acceptable. So get out of howdy doody world and get back to the real world.
Get out of howdy doody world, indeed. Okay. Right. Next up in-house, Food for the Soul.
So Nina Hein we have launched a new website for Food for the Soul. It's easier to navigate. It's absolutely beautiful. And she has a great new column on Sargent. And of course, 2 weeks ago, she had a great column on the Tate exhibit for women artists from, Lord, I think it was 1500 to date. Anyway, but two great new columns from Nina. And the new website is beautiful. It's just, you just tons of eye candy. So, and we're coming out with her book, Women in Art, which is a collection of all her Women in Art columns, which you can see on the website. So if you feel like taking a break and just really enjoying some beautiful writing and beautiful pictures, Food for the Soul.
Excellent. And with that, that wraps it up for this week of Money and Markets.
Okay, John. I will see you next week. I want to remind everybody we're not having Money and Markets in the last 2 weeks of August because even John and I deserve vacations, right?
Yeah, we're taking a break.
Yeah, we're taking a break. Yeah. Okay, but we'll see you next week.
Okay, see you next week.
I'll be in the United States.
That's right.
Yeah.
I knew that already.
Yeah, I'll be in Philadelphia. I'll be in Westchester.
Right.
Anyways,
okay.
See you from Westchester next week. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report. You have a great week.